And well, thank you for that, you know. And just finished a month-long residency at the Clifford Still Museum in Denver. You might want to explain that, what that's about. Please, a warm welcome for Paul.
All right, Paul.
Tradition of clapping all the way.
Oh, all the way.
That's old news.
That's
a
it's only for C&T.
Wait.
Okay, Paul, I just want to make sure you're in the frame.
Well, since Leopoldo found out just before this started, let's just take a moment to think about Kerwin, a moment of silence to honor the memory of a man who was very important in this community. I think I first met Kuhn, probably was connected to Red Sky Poetry Theater, and someone said, Ferlinghetti blurbed him. It's like, whoa! And then you get the book and you realize, oh, I see why Ferlinghetti gave him a blurb, because he could deliver. He was a real poet. He also published one of my books. It's a great story. We're going to honor the memory of Kuhn at the 10th Cascadia Poetry Festival, October 9, 10, 11. There are bookmarks there on that table if you're interested. We'll also be honoring the memory of Margareta Waterman, old Red Sky people,
Margareta,
and David McCloskey, who coined the notion of Cascadia as a bioregion. So, and hopefully that's all, but who knows, between now and October 11th when that'll happen at the Rainier Beach Community Club. This book is, this is a galley edition. I still have to go through and find the typos and send them back to Greg Bem. But this is The Singing Bullets of Soft Secession and Other Day Songs. And I asked Kuhn if I could have permission to include one of his poems in here when I published it, and he said yes. And it was Kuhn's poem called Why I Write. Not for ambition or for bread or a command performance before a queen. I write because uncomfortable feelings rise to my throat and writing them out prevents my possible death by choking. I seek to pull together opposites that, when each is alone, none is complete. And since I am a being in the world, my cares aren't solely my own. Thus I write to unveil the world, to strip it naked and alone, so we can all see what it is we call home. Lastly, I write to mourn all the lives I didn't live. I thought about them, sometimes long and hard. In the end, I chose to stay with a common mess. And of this mess, I managed to find something to bard. Why I write to Kuhn. Literature is the profound study of life, you write, and the command is that which painter Clifford Still articulated. Demands for communication are presumptuous and irrelevant. A harsh pill for the ego-driven. And you know that, Kuhn, unveiling the world you create, one syllable, one critique session, one poetry reading at a time. Time is nothing but being, Dogen wrote, and somehow you live that, Kuhn. We love that you chose this one life to live, in the ancient rain of West Seattle, brightening your light as the cancer closes in, to show those left behind the way forward. Kuhn's found his ground in the ancient rain of West Seattle, in the cozy coffee house they saved, in the lineage of wisdom keepers, used language to weep, monitored every morning siren standing their ground, with the strongest territorial response, with a variety of attack, with the valor and tenacity of Song Sparrow. So that's a segment from that first poem of five poems that were day songs written each on one day. I'll be doing the next one on August 30th. And it's probably going to have a lot of Clifford Still in it because I did this residency at the Clifford Still Museum. Oh, shit, I realized I haven't mailed this one. I better get this out. He did a lot of train paintings in Alberta. Clifford Still was born in North Dakota but moved to Spokane when he was less than a year old. And he studied painting at Washington State College before it was a university. And he moved to San Francisco and then New York, also taught in Virginia. And Jackson Pollock said, he makes us all look academic. And I applied for and was fortunate enough to get a residency for the month of July, the very hot month of July, at the Clifford Still Museum in Denver. I've got a couple of catalogs of his, one from early work that he did on the Colville Reservation in Nespelem, which has had horrible fires this year, devastated in Chilium, and the other one about his later work when he lived in Maryland. And I started writing this at the Community of Writers in California, in Olympic Valley, that Brenda Hillman is now involved in making go. And this first quote really kind of explains where I was, what I was thinking at the time I started writing this. Still in Cascadia. If you write poetry at all, do you think, God, I'm never going to write again. I've never got it right. But if you've got a project, my theory is that you ask the universe a question, it's going to answer you one way or another, no matter how you look at it, no matter where you go. It could be just looking at the sidewalk, or it could be looking at the town or something, whatever Victorian poets did. But if you goddamn well ask it a question, it's going to give you the answer. Ronald Johnson, from a 1985 talk in Madison, Wisconsin. Clifford Still, in Cascadia, knew Adam, naked, mud-colored, primal, as the way out of the Euclidean prison. And how Nespelem had fit in, feather feud consciousness and bile into constellations of muscle and ochre and thunderstorms of sesquioxide, a palette knife resurrection. It was Adam in the Palouse, 146 by 89 centimeters, ribs black, negative space, hands and legs and skull too large for the barn. Dragon imagination, air and light, rather than the physiognomy of the landscape, the people, and the machines. That's the Adam referenced in the poem. You see the hands on that. He was starting to veer into abstraction. Dragon imagination, epigraph Diane de Prima. The only war that matters is the war against the imagination. All other wars are subsumed in it. Wood Dragon, Sagittarius, November 30, 1904. Quote, those born in 1904 are wood dragons, characterized by their natural leadership abilities and innovative thinking. The wood element enhances the dragon's natural characteristics, adding flexibility and creativity. Sagittarius, independent and strong-willed, they know why. November 30, 1904, numerology. Quote, an excessively strong and authoritative person who never doubts their rightness and therefore the right to act according to their own desires in each and every situation. Pressing them is like triggering an anti-personnel mine. This quality is a huge threat both to its bearer and the people around. For the latter, such willpower manifestations are close to tyranny, with even the minimum essential needs of others not being taken into account. It may take a dragon imagination, for instance, to make a compositional method marked by the removal and joining together of formal units. To begin the abstraction of verticality, the lifeline, asclepian, columnar, despite an obvious emaciation in Adam anyway, the shoulders of PH 208, 1940. By 1941, space and figure in canvases, quote, resolved into a total psychic entity. Age 37, Pullman, Washington. Space and figure, figure and space, fused into an instrument bounded only by the limits of my energy and intuition. 11 years before the first mention of action painting, a columnar flash. Yellow rivulets beginning to reverse the relation of figure to ground, with a palette knife and a dragon fire, with a rugged gravity in a barnyard resurrection, no longer drawn, but sculpted on the canvas like pieces of earth. Sculpted on the earth like pieces of canvas, maybe Cooley-esque. Cooley or Cooley is any of various different landforms, all of which are kinds of valleys or drainage zones. The word coulee comes from the Canadian French coulee, from the French couler, to flow. Many coulees in the Great Plains, none though like the one named Grand. Grand and Great were the words settlers settled for when encountering the North American West. Matisse, headed to Pittsburgh, 1930, said, American artists should wander abroad in search of subjects when they have at home scenes of such varied beauty. T. Lofton Johnson, artist, editorialist, teacher at West Point, put it clear, formalities belong to Europe. Eager, primitive strength belong to America. Clifford Elmer Still sensed something about the 60-million-year-old underlying granite bedrock of which the Grand Coulee's made. Volcanoes and glaciers, ice dams and basalt. Somewhat different than Cleveland or Pittsburgh. Not like Giverny nor Noonan, Herwin, and Netterbetten and its paintings of potato eaters. Here in the primal landscape of the Columbia River, in the land scraped by cataclysmic floods and glaciation, here find the substrate of a Cascadian abstraction Sagittarius, a wood dragon with the ethos of a pastel locomotive, whose perception is gravity and digestion, whose gestures Cascadian with a time arc rivaling granite, who'd steal a piece of divine fire from the most cunning of artificers and sculpt the canvas with the muscle of Cascadian subduction. Underneath the muscle of Cascadian subductions, the dirt and granite, what runs us, dirt mother, the locals know. Clifford somehow knew he needed out via linseed and lightning, watercolors and a healthy skepticism of gravity. Don the tools of ignorance for the Spokane U baseball team. Be undefeated one year. Pencil out the rigors of Alberta homesteading. Wait for the other jaw to drop. Newman and Rothko were influenced by indigenous art. Clifford Still co-founded the Nez Pelham art colony on the Colville Reservation, lived with indigenous people. You could get a transmission from a culture who has ghosts with red and blue flames in place of intestines. Review the archaeology of his own self-identity, one critic said. Stanley Krippner'd say personal mythology, not unlike manipulation of glazes in oil paint to achieve translucent impasto, poetics as cosmology. In Pullman and Yaddo, Clifford Still was testing it out to soon help usher in the culture of spontaneity via sinuous pigment lifelines, abandonment of representation, bolts of ochre, signposts of allegory, the still life of one continental plate being crushed under another.
Cool.
Do I have time for one more?
I don't know. I haven't been keeping track.
You haven't been keeping track? This is this is a longer one. I ended my presentation on the 27th, which was recorded by the museum and will be online. And they will continue this institute. Clifford Still kept 93% of his work. And in his will, he said, I will donate it to an American city that creates a building for the ongoing study and exhibition of my work. And Denver took two cracks at it. The second one, Clifford Still's widow said, yes, you will get the paintings. And they sold four paintings to get the money to run the place. And they got $90 million for those four paintings.
Wow, cool.
So the art, they said, don't say this out loud. The art in that museum is worth $3 billion if you were to piece it out. And so he was really disgusted by the art business. And so he said, fuck it, I'll just keep it and give it to a city. So I think his gesture is probably going to outlast capitalism. At least that's what I'm rooting for. So I ended with this. And so you to get a sense of the kind of person he was and the kind of commitment he had for this notion that he did not want to sell his work, There's a poem in here. I don't really have this too laid out good because it's not in manuscript form. But there's a poem about this man who was sort of a patron of Clifford's, and then they had a differing of opinion. And this takes you through it. And I thought I had this neatly organized. Just give me one more moment. Here it is. Now, I was alone. My wife came to visit near the end to see my presentation. So if I had insomnia because of the 100-degree heat and the lack of central air conditioning and the altitude, I'd get up at 3:21 and I'd start writing, or I'd read in my journal. And in my journal one day were a couple of entries about Barry McKinnon. And Barry McKinnon had this phrase that gives part of the title. So this is a long poem, and I'll thank you for your kind attention. And Leopoldo, this is such a beautiful community. I'm so grateful to be part of it. So I'm grateful that Kuhn connected us. Still cuts the heart out of the global manufactured. The unfinished theology embodied in the space of thought. Barry McKinnon. As in each poem, an unfinished theology, slice of a whole. Yet there were those poets, barely anthologizable, who wanted more than a plane for their poems, more than the cop-out of the dodges of discourse for a poet who is not describing, but enacting in the blue-necked universe. Barry called it the global manufactured, and as a poet with a few financial rewards, he could take such a stand, with pension checks from College of New Caledonia. As he said to Cecil Giscombe, "My job as a poet is to see and unravel arbitrary and preconceived notions and definitions of reality, including what I might conjure as my own. The poet can't help but do this because of the very nature of the energy and process of the language that's chosen him or her. What has been mapped by manipulative and self-interested forces from whatever source or reason is firstly what the poet must, at the most rudimental start of the thinking and writing process, attempt to take apart. I must find myself asking unanswerable questions. There is no choice." By the late 1950s, abstract expressionist men got caught in what Michael Auping called aesthetic territorial skirmishes. Still was an outsider in New York, a man whose agenda was so radically self-determined that he rejected the camaraderie of an avant-garde. Still seemed to cherish above all else a kind of waspish distance from colleagues and even friends. These men read their press and dog-like wanted to piss highest on the abstract expressionist wall. Alfonso Osorio, quote, was born in Manila August 2, 1916. His father started the first sugar refinery in the central Philippines, the Victorious Milling Company on the island of Occidental Negros. The younger Osorio attended private schools in England and the U.S., graduated from Harvard 1938, also attended Rhode Island School of Design, and in 1939 was naturalized as an American citizen. Artist, collector, maker of congregations, all manner of such found materials as fake jewels, glass eyes, mirror shards, shells, bones, beads, buttons, plastic waste, antlers, horseshoes, and so forth, and set into refulgent beds of plastic glue and then richly varnished. He bought Still's work, was loaned other paintings, and underestimated Clifford's contempt of group exhibitions and his ambivalence about showing work in Europe. From Clifford Still's journal, "I didn't want to do what I had to do last Sunday, January 12, 1958. He'd loaned a painting to his supporter and friend Alfonso so that the people who came to hear the little opera would be reminded the painting was with them. Alfonso seemed to forget it was alone, but not Clifford. "I have found it very hard to retrieve a picture once you've allowed it to be hung on someone's wall. They identify with it, seize it, and somehow come to feel that they own, possess everything about it. Jackson Pollock recommended the painting to a collector that Clifford decided should not own the painting. Ben Heller, real estate tycoon, textile mogul, who launched abstract expressionism into the financial stratosphere, selling Pollock's blue poles to the Australian government for $1.3 million. To Still, his pictures, anyway, were living beings, more than all that rabbit collagen, and not commodities. Heller was a collector, a seller. Quote, "Alfonso brought the racial question into our discussion and elevated it to a position above those ideas to which I dedicated my life and to which I thought he was interested. Arts administrator Porter McCray suggested Alfonso donate 1955K number 2, a Still replica, to UNESCO. McCray told Still at the Oasis restaurant, told Still, Alfonso looked horrified. Quote, suddenly the whole poisonous mess began to boil again. Art must not be owned by those who buy it. That is really of the artist and should be respected so. And as long as I live, I consider the work subject to my direction. Reduction of higher values, Clifford maintained. It was nasty social exploitation and a prevention of the imaginative life. It created ambition and fear and competitive hatreds. Clifford's gift was painting as gesture against the street and its exploitation of the human spirit. Clifford learned Alfonso did not get this. It was not a kindred spirit in painting as cosmology. He just wanted to live a good art life with congregations in the Whitney. Clifford called him a common whore, believing in his money. And with wife Patricia and daughter Diane, took the train to East Hampton, then a cab to the creeks Albert Herder once owned. Clifford knew what he had to do with this painting, no longer alive. Painting now a pawn, a poisonous thing dangerous to see. Power, property. And so Clifford engaged in a surgical operation, cutting out 1955 K number 2's rectangular heart and a flame from the lower right-hand corner, folded the bits up into a flat bundle. Don't ever try to tell me what I can do with my painting, mister. Don't try and tell me what I can do with my work. The rage cooled on the train ride home. The same state made by a devotion to verticality. An imagination in service to what Still felt sacred gave him, he felt, some ability to discern the sentience in a 7-year-old painting few others can, without sacraments or fasting or some childlike innocence or shamanic juju. Painting as beyond an artifact of cultural weapons and an alibi for cowardice and power. He'd seen the soul of Nespelum stacked and piled in the middle, recognized its inherent verticality, where power is not money power, but something gained via practice, fasting, prayer, kokoro, gebo, shinjin datsaraku, something more potent and lasting than daddy's portfolio. And so goes the soliloquy of Clifford Still, whose paintings are still alive as the Amtrak and the Jaguar in the garage, and the memory of Alberta farmhands just trying to make it to spring.
All right. Mm.
Thanks. So I'll hang out by the books there and...